Welcome to Transnational Encounters, German and British Romanticism, a seminar at the University of Stuttgart in winter semester 2025-26 with Jessica Bunchu and Tony Bernhardt.
Studentische Konferenz der Abteilungen Englische Literaturen und Kulturen und Neuere Deutsche Literatur am Institut für Literaturwissenschaft.
This is part 3. Enjoy.
All right, hello and welcome everybody to session 3 of our student conference on transnational romanticism, and welcome back to our third discussion. We'll cover quite some poetic distance today with our discussion of some romantic poems and their recordings. And with me today I have Larissa.
Hi.
We also have Johanna.
Hello.
And last but not least, Zoe.
Hey, I'm Zoe.
Okay, and so we have quite some diverse poems, and we will transgress some national borders also in our language use today, but we will start with one of the probably foremost faces of Romanticism in Lord Byron.
She walks in beauty, by Lord Byron. She walks in beauty, like the night, of cloudless climes and starry skies, and all that's best of dark and bright meet in her aspect and her eyes. Thus mellowed to that tender light which heaven to gaudy day denies. One shade the more, one ray the less, had half impaired the nameless grace which waves in every raven tress or softly lightens o'er her face, where thoughts serenely sweet express how pure, how dear their dwelling place. And on that cheek and o'er that brow, so soft, so calm, yet eloquent, the smiles that win, the tints that glow, but tell of days in goodness spent, a mind at peace with all below, a heart whose love is innocent.
Right, thank you so much. Is there any aspect of that poem that particularly piqued your interest, which you could share with us?
You know, I have to say, when I first chose this poem, I kind of skimmed it and I thought, okay, well, this is a nice love poem. I'll choose this for my recitation. But when I did my close reading in preparation for the recitation, I thought about, well, what's the poet's agenda? What's the poem's agenda? And then I kind of came to thinking, well, it's not really romantic in a way that there's an expression of love in that sense, because the speaker is quite distanced. It's also written in third person. So it does have an appreciative tone, in my opinion, and gentle as well, but it's not very lovey. And I guess my question to you both is, well, do you think this is a love poem, or what do you think makes this then a romantic poem?
So what I noticed when reading the poem was that he referred to the muse as unknown. So he said beauty is unknown. He said nameless grace. And that's why I think the conception of beauty in this very poem is that beauty is unknown. He also emphasized innocence and the pure character, and to me it almost reads like it was just this fleeting moment of the subject perceiving this unknown beauty. So I don't think it is a love poem, because for me love means to know someone and to know every aspect of them, and so I would say it's more of an admiration. That's what you also said. The moment is quite peaceful and filled with rather calm emotions, and it's not burdened yet by this weight of heavy emotions like love. And so therefore it is a very innocent moment, and the story, the love story, is yet to be told. I don't think there's love to be found.
Yeah, I agree with your notion of that it's more of an infatuation and not really love yet. I also think that it's more a poem about like an abstract concept of beauty, and also beauty that depends on the individual person. So we have beauty that is attached to a notion of a physical appearance, but we also have beauty that kind of reaches beyond physical appearances here with the smile, for example, or the goodness within the admired person. I also think that it's more about admiring someone from afar and contemplating notions of beauty more than love per se.
Yeah, I like that you used the word infatuation as well, because I think also that this woman's beauty is maybe an ideal version of her. This is probably not realistic. So I also think that it participates in romanticist idealization, I'd say.
Yeah.
So admiration fits.
Yeah, for sure. I think it's also very interesting that even though it's like full of idealization, we also have this notion of dark and bright. So it isn't all bright. We also have the night. So these darker aspects. And so I think it's also a poem about balance, like balancing opposed concepts and bringing them together in this beloved. And I think like this notion of balance and of trying to achieve a sense of harmony is also a core concept of romanticism.
Yes, definitely. I think you also find it in this poem with, you have basically two subjects, nature and the woman, and what connects the two is beauty. And the woman is beautiful because she's also, she has a virtuous mind, I guess, a pure, serenely sweet, express her thoughts.
I think there is an interesting point there to say, okay, what does this description marvel at? So what are this poem starts on the strong simile. It starts on this, like the night. And there we have then this one could see it as juxtaposition. One could see it as conjunction between nature and that human beauty that's being marveled at. And so I guess one question to decide then is, if this is not a love poem or an admiration poem, I guess we can balance that spectrum. What does this description actually marvel at? What's the core object of admiration in those lines?
Well, I would like to connect to what I said earlier. I think the unknown is kind of is a core concept that could be found, because I think it's supposed to the sense of finality, because the moment is yet to be experienced. And I also think the juxtaposition to nature or to day and night is like day and night, it's kind of eternal. You can always count on there to be another day and another night. Like night coming is a given, and so I think it's just a matter of compressing the possibility of being into this short encounter.
Well, I think to me, where the main subject is really nature, this woman is beautiful because she is like the night. Well, that would be a more straightforward reading, but that would be my reading.
Yeah, I agree with your readings, and also the connection of nature and something that is mysterious. Like Zoe, you mentioned like the unknown, the nameless grace, someone you see for a moment, and this moment is also fleeting. So I think there are a lot of concepts combined, and they are so powerful in this poem, because the poet uses nature to, or this likening to nature, to bring across all these aspects, like the fleetingness, the mysteriousness, through like that tender light. So it's all about vagueness in a way, so about also negative capability. Yeah,
I think that is a good point to emphasize here, to say, okay, this first line and the title kind of summarizes it for us. There's the simile, but there's also this idea she walks in beauty, this aspect of transgression, of walking, of whatever that she is, it immerses itself and herself in some sort of world. And there we have that idea of humanity in nature and vice versa. And I think that is a nice idea that we can use to jump to our next poem, which would be Johanna's choice of poem.
An die Melancholie von Nikolaus Lenau. Du geleitest mich durchs Leben, sinnende Melancholie. Mag mein Stern sich strahlend heben, mag er sinken, weichest nie. Führst mich oft in Felsenklüfte, wo der Adler einsam haust. Tannen starren in die Lüfte und der Waldstrom donnernd braust. Meiner Toten dann gedenk ich, wild hervor die Träne bricht, und an deinen Busen senk ich mein umnachtet Angesicht.
Ja, wunderbar. Deshalb hier mal unser kleiner Language Switch ins Deutsche für dieses deutsche romantische Gedicht. Inspiriert dich bei dieser Gedichtwahl? Hier zwei ähnliche Themen, beide ein Vergleich zwischen einem menschlichen Sentiment und einer natürlichen Impression. Was waren deine Beweggründe für diese Wahl?
Also mich hat an dem Gedicht sehr angesprochen, dass es eben in dieser Du-Form geschrieben ist, also dass wir die Melancholie als Adressatin quasi haben, also diese Idee der Apostrophe, dass sich so an dieses abstrakte Konzept der Melancholie direkt gewandt wird. Und ich fand es sehr spannend, dass das lyrische Ich dann an die Melancholie spricht und nicht über die Melancholie. Und da wollte ich euch fragen, was denkt ihr, warum an die Melancholie sprechen und nicht einfach über die Melancholie?
Also als ich das Gedicht gelesen habe, mir ist die Melancholie wie so eine Konstante aufgefallen, also wie quasi auf eine Person, auf die man sich verlassen kann, auf die man zählen kann, die immer da ist, egal wie man sich jetzt fühlt. Und die Melancholie hat auch so, für mich hat sich das gelesen, als wäre das nicht nur eine, also dass die quasi mehrere Emotionen einschließt, also dass es so ein Spektrum quasi ist, also zum Beispiel Wut und Einsamkeit und dieses Aufbrausende, aber es kann auch still sein, also diese Tannen, wo starren. Das hat mir dann eher diese Stille gegeben. Für mich hat sich das gelesen wie so zwei Extreme und also auch die Melancholie nicht nur als Ursprung von diesen extremen Emotionen, sondern auch als Erinnerung und als Zuflucht. Quasi auch wenn es der Ursprung dieser negativen Emotion ist, dann ist, kann man sich da doch in Zuversicht wissen, dass man sich daran erinnert und dass es dann bei einem bleibt. Also wie jemand, auf den man sich verlassen kann, also eine Person quasi.
Ja, also ich habe es eigentlich auch so gelesen, dass die Melancholie eine, also auf jeden Fall eine Person ist. Ich meine, wir haben ja da auch eine Personifizierung und an deinen Busen senke ich. Also ich würde sagen, dass die Melancholie schon eine Freundin oder ein Freund ist, aber ich kann mich noch nicht entscheiden, ob die Melancholie jetzt wirklich hilft oder eher eine Last ist für das lyrische Ich.
In dem Gedicht wird es nicht wirklich aufgelöst, dieser Konflikt, und das ist wahrscheinlich auch das Herz der Melancholie, dass es eben diese beiden Seiten gibt, dass sie einerseits schön, aber auch schmerzhaft sein kann, da sie eben diese Konfrontation mit den eigenen Emotionen, mit den eigenen inneren Abgründen vielleicht auch voraussetzt und es natürlich auch schmerzhaft sein kann. Und ich finde, das Gedicht, das balanciert diese zwei Pole auch, gerade durch seinen Aufbau und wie es auch eben formal gestaltet ist, sehr aus. Also wir haben am Anfang dieses Sinnende und dieses Weiches nie, also diese fast schon ungläubige Realisation, dass die Melancholie ja irgendwie da ist, jemand, auf den man sich verlassen kann. Aber dann in der zweiten Strophe, ich finde, die macht so einen starken Kontrast auf. Wir haben auf einmal Felsenklüfte, Tannen, die starren, den Waldstrom, der donnernd braust. Also das ist ja fast schon so Onomatopoesie, dass da diese R- und S- und F-Töne, quasi diese Geräuschkulisse des Waldes zu imitieren. Und wie lest ihr denn diese Strophe? Also was sind denn die Felsenklüfte und die starrenden Tannen und der Waldstrom? Also seht ihr da irgendwie so eine tiefere Ebene oder ist es für euch einfach nur eine Natur? Oder ja?
Also was ich auch gedacht habe, ist, dass es, also dadurch, dass es auch mit der Natur verbunden ist, dass es vielleicht auch so eine Optionalität gibt, diesen Raum zu betreten, also in Melancholie zu schwelgen quasi. Und dann auch die Art von Natur, die eben wiederzufinden ist im Gedicht. Also einmal diese Felsenklüfte, diese Tiefen, in die man versenken kann. um diese negativen Emotionen hervorzuheben. Was zu mir gesprochen hat, waren diese Tannen, die in die Lüfte starren. Also das ist vielleicht auch eher so stagniert, dieses Gefühl, dass man sich vielleicht ein bisschen verloren fühlt und nicht weiß, wie man wieder aus dieser Melancholie herauskommt.
Ja, also ich würde die Beschreibung der Natur auf jeden Fall auch auf emotionaler Ebene ein bisschen lesen. Vor allem, weil es dann auch in der dritten Strophe dann schon auch emotional wird. Mir hat auch gefallen, wie du meiner Toten dann gedenke ich wild hervor, die Träne bricht, gelesen hast, okay. Weil da auch was Gegensätzliches drinsteckt. Ich meine, wenn ich an den Tod denke, dann denke ich eher an Ruhe, aber die Tränen brechen dann wild hervor.
Ja, ich finde es auch sehr emotional, die Strophe und auch so eine Art Rahmen wird dann wieder gespannt zur ersten Strophe, weil man hat als erstes Wort das Du und dann das erste Wort im letzten Vers ist mein, also diese Verbindung von Ich und Du, was ja auch so diese Apostrophe ausmacht, dass es ein Ich und ein Du gibt und da so sich ein Raum zwischen diesen beiden Instanzen so entspinnt.
Ja, ich denke, was wir hier ähnlich wie in Lord Byrons Gedicht sehen, ist diese Überlagerung, die zwischen einem natürlichen Objekt und einem menschlichen Objekt passiert. Hier sind Eigenschaften, die sich ganz klar überschneiden. Und deshalb auch hier nochmal die Frage, vielleicht die uns zurückführen kann dazu, inwieweit überlappen sich diese Subjekte? Also an welchen Busen wird sich am Ende gesenkt? Weil die geliebte Person scheint ja nicht mehr hier zu sein. Ist es die Natur? In dem Fall auch dann, was ist das Du? Wer wird hier adressiert? Kann man das noch entzerren am Ende des Gedichts? Oder wen seht ihr als das unterliegende Objekt am Ende dieses Gedichtes?
Das erste Mal, als ich das gelesen habe, war auf jeden Fall, ich habe gedacht, dass er die Melancholie meint. Aber wenn man dann drüber nachdenkt, dann finde ich, ist es auch zu lesen, als dass man sich auf sich selbst vertrauen kann und dass man selbst den Weg quasi aus dieser Melancholie wieder rausfinden muss. Also Trost finden in der Tatsache, dass es vielleicht auch wieder vorbeigeht.
Ja, und ich meine, die Auseinandersetzung mit der Melancholie, die führt dich ja auch wieder zu dir selbst zurück. Also es ist ja eine Auseinandersetzung mit seiner eigenen Trauer. Also ich denke, dass das Du und das Ich irgendwie so zusammenschmelzen. Und ich meine, wir haben auch in der ersten Strophe zum Beispiel sinnende Melancholie, aber eigentlich ist es ja das lyrische Ich, das gerade hier nachsinnt über die Melancholie. Also da findet so ein Übertrag an Eigenschaften statt und da merken schon, dass das Du und das Ich sich zu überlappen beginnen und verschmelzen und dann kommt noch die Natur mit rein. Also irgendwie wird alles so kombiniert, würde ich sagen.
Ich finde da der Aspekt der Verschmelzung nicht nur zweier Objekte, sondern auch des Subjekts, finde ich da eine wichtige Anerkennung in diesem Gedicht und der Auseinandersetzung. Und die Auseinandersetzung, die sieht man bisher in allen Gedichten und die sieht man auch besonders im letzten Gedicht, wo aber das Objekt noch ein bisschen menschlichere Form annimmt, nämlich die klare Adressierung an Coleridge. Und da kommen wir dann zu Zoes Poem.
To the Poet Coleridge by Mary Robinson. Wrapped in the visionary theme, spirit divine, with thee I'll wander, where the blue, wavy, lucid stream, mid forest glooms shall slow meander, with thee I'll trace the circling bounds of thy new paradise extended, and listen to the varying sounds of winds and foamy torrents blended. Now, by the source which laboring heaves, the mystic fountain, bubbling, panting, while gossamer its network weaves, adown the blue lawn slanting. I'll mark thy sunny dome and view thy caves of ice, thy fields of dew, thy ever-blooming mead whose flower waves to the cold breath of the moonlight hour. Or when the day star peering bright on the grey wing of parting night, while more than vegetating power throbs grateful to the burning hour, as summer's whispered sighs unfold her million, million buds of gold, then will I climb the breezy bounds of thy new paradise extended and listen to the different sounds of winds and foamy torrents blended. Spirit divine, with thee I'll trace imagination's boundless space. With thee, beneath thy sunny dome, I listen to the minstrel's lay, hymning the gradual close of day. In caves of ice, enchanted Rome, whereon the glittering entrance plays, the moon's beam with its silvery rays, or when glassy stream that through the deep fell flows, flashes the noon's hot beam that midway shows,
thy flaming temple studded o'er with all Peruvia's lustrous store. There will I trace the circling bounds of thy new paradise extended, and listen to the awful sounds of winds and foamy torrents blended. And now I'll pause to catch the moan of distant breezes cavern pent, now, ere the twilight tints are flown, purpling the landscape far and wide, on the dark promontory side. I'll gather wild flowers, dew besprent, and weave a crown for thee, genius of heaven-thought poesy, while opening to my wandering eyes, thou bidst a new creation rise, I'll rapture trace the circling bounds of thy rich paradise extended, and listen to the varying sounds of winds and foaming torrents blended. And now, with lofty tones inviting, thy nymph, her dulcimer swift smiting, shall wake me in ecstatic measures, far, far removed from mortal pleasures, in cadence rich, in cadence strong, proving the wondrous witcheries of song. I hear her voice, thy sunny dome, thy caves of ice, a loud repeat, vibrations maddening sweet, calling the visionary wanderer home. She sings of thee, O favored child, of minstrelsy sublimely wild, of thee whose soul can feel the tone, which gives to airy dreams a magic all their own. So my poem is to the poet Coleridge, and it's in the title. It's the apostrophe is in dedication to the poet Coleridge. The poem is charged with curiosity, admiration, sense of adventure and wonder. And the subject, the lyrical I, addresses a divine spirit and professes the lengths it will follow to be a part of its paradise and to experience these new wonders. And it doesn't matter if the experiences are good or bad, because it keeps referencing these winds and foamy torrents, and I think it's just about the experience itself. My first question to you guys is, do you think the apostrophe elevates Coleridge to a symbol rather than a private individual?
Yeah, definitely. I think it's quite inherent to the apostrophe that it elevates the addressee. So I think this is probably the biggest compliment to Coleridge, because he, in this poem, he is a divine spirit. It says in line 53, a genius of heaven-taught poesy.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I agree. I also marked this line in my head, the genius of heaven-taught poesy. So Coleridge, in a way, turns into the spirit of poesy himself. I also read this poem as an ode to imagination, and kind of Coleridge and the idea of imagination, they kind of become one in this poem. The lyrical I kind of wants to join Coleridge on his journey into this magical or paradisical realm. And it's actually a realm created through imagination. It's kind of an illusion. It's a paradise built in one's mind. I definitely see the sense of elevating him into something bigger than an individual here.
Yeah, what I also noticed, or when I read it, I also kind of read it in a way that he is, or he becomes, this divine spirit that enables the reader to experience this paradise. There wouldn't be a new paradise without this new point of view that he's opening up to the reader. By dedicating this poem to him, she makes him eternal, and he, like, the image of him being the poet, this divine spirit, is eternal. He becomes, like, this is his final form in a sense. These quotes, like spirit divine or imagination's boundless space, really stuck to me, because it's just she compresses this admiration and she puts it into these natural images, and nature is full of wonders that are beyond the rational understanding. And I also think this, in a way, is the sublime and the new paradise that the subject is seeking to experience. Mm-hmm. And at the end, towards the end of the poem, the subject is calling a child home. And my question is, do you think this is an incentive for the reader to come back into this sublime realm, into this realm of imagination, to experience the world in a more whimsical sense, through a lens that maybe focuses more on natural wonders? Or is it the opposite? Is it an incentive to experience the world in a more bodily image, so to maybe turn off your brain in a sense and just really be present in the moment and take it all in?
Mm-hmm. I think it's kind of both. I think because the sublime, it isn't sustainable. Like the sublime, it is something that you experience in a moment. So it's this kind of this momentary expansion that you sense. So the speaker and also we as readers, we kind of know that this this paradisical realm, it is kind of out of reach, and we can only inhabit it for a limited amount of time. But what we can do, we can be more in tune with our senses, and that's something that kind of a way that we can feel the echoes of the sublime also when we're out of this space again, because we have like all this allusion to the senses. We have a lot of sound here, we have a lot of sight, and we also have a sense of tactility in the poem, so synesthesia in a way. So to sum up, the poem in my opinion kind of embraces both this notion of momentarily being in a realm that is kind of out of reach, also with like tenses. We're often in future tense, but sometimes we're in present tense, so it's this approximation of something that is out of reach, and we can inhabit it for a moment, but then to make an impression last, it kind of works through the senses.
Yeah, I'd agree, and I think that also fits with the idea that imagination is such a big topic in this poem, and that's also the power of the poet Coleridge, is his imaginative power that you can harness through art and poetry.
Yeah, and I think that the experience is fundamentally fluid, so it's not about one way of experiencing it, but maybe being able to choose and switch in and out of different perspectives, and that's what makes the experience beautiful, is the different regards, the different perspectives that you can inhabit and that broaden your imagination and your conscious.
Yeah, I think what you three unearth here is sort of a larger question of this almost meta poem, right? What we can also ask, what does this romantic poem know about romanticism? And I think it makes us acutely aware of this idea that, yes, romanticism and romantic poetry is a lot about this marveling at an object, whatever shape this object may take. Is that a person? Is that an emotion, a sentiment, a part of nature? All of it. But ultimately that object becomes a mirror back to the subject. And I think we see that across the poems here. We see that in She Walks in Beauty, in sort of the conflation of a human and a natural entity. We see that in Andy Melancholie, in this complete overlapping almost of these two entities and the subject sort of being thrown in the mix there. And we certainly see it in this clear address and the admiration that emerges in Mary Robinson's poem. And I think admiration is a united aspect of these three poems, and also one that I share. I admire your discourse, your conversation, and this has been very fun to listen over, to be a part of. And so I think we need to conclude now, and I want to thank you very much for your time, for this fun chat, and
Thank you too.